Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of True Crime All the Time. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson.
Hey.
What's going on, Gibby?
Not much, man. Just excited to do another podcast with you.
So we're taping Friday night.
Friday night.
After work.
We have normal jobs, too.
Yeah, we do have normal jobs, for sure. And I think we got a really fascinating story.
It's intriguing.
So we're talking about Herb Baumeister.
We are.
And we may butcher that name, but...
I will.
Also known as the I-70 Strangler, which is a little crazy because you live very, very close to I-70.
Right. The I-70 Strangler part gets attached later. Yeah, I mean, not much later, but eventually they'd start tying in Ohio.
All right, so we do have some shout-outs today. We got three new Patreon supporters. So excited. We got Janet. We've got Maggie, who goes by Storm, as we know her.
Right.
And we've got Aaron.
Aaron.
So
Janet, Stormy, and,
and Aaron. Yeah. So great week, and thank you so much, all three of you, for your support. It really does go a long way to help keep the show going, helps pay for production costs and media hosting and all that good stuff. So, you know, anyone can help support the show. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/truecrimeallthetime. You know, Gibby and I have been posting teasers for upcoming episodes. We recently posted some cutting room floor blooper stuff that a lot of people seemed to like. It was pretty funny, I thought. And anything else we think people will like. So, you know, definitely check out the Patreon page. And then lastly, as I always say, make sure you visit our website, truecrimeallthetime.com. You'll see all of our social media contact information. We've been getting so much interaction on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, and we love it. We try to respond to everybody all the time. And even through email, right, Gabe? We've been getting a lot of email.
A lot of emails.
From all over the world. Just within the past couple of weeks, we've gotten a lot of emails from outside the United States as well. Make sure you tell all of your friends who are into true crime about the podcast. You know, that word of mouth goes a long way towards helping us out, as does going out and rating reviewing us on iTunes, if that's the way that you use it, or, you know, whatever platform you're listening to the show on. If there's a way to rate and review, you know, that's something that we'd ask you to do. It really helps us out. Hey, folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime, and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. So, Gibby, are you ready to talk about Herb Baumeister?
I am.
Herb Baumeister was a family man, right?
Right.
He had built a successful business. It would be revealed over time, though, that Herb was an alleged prolific serial killer. Now, normally on this show, we don't use the word alleged, right? Because we're able to say that this person's gone through the court system and we know all the crimes and they've been convicted and all of that. Yeah, this case is very strange in that way because we have to use the word alleged, but we don't want to give away the reason why. So
right.
You got to listen to the story. And all the twists and turns.
It all makes sense in the end.
And it will all make sense in the end. As always, let's talk about Herb's early life. You know, he was born on April 7th, 1947. His parents were Dr. Herbert and Elizabeth Baumeister. They lived in Indiana. His father was an anesthesiologist. So, you know, the family had to have some money.
Should have done pretty well.
Yeah, I think, you know, they grew up with money. He had a younger sister and two younger brothers.
Right.
And I think Herb's childhood seemed pretty normal at first. But with every case that we do, the childhood
gets a little twisted.
Gets twisted at some point. And as he got just a little bit older, I think those signs would come out that old Herb just wasn't quite right. His bizarre behavior would later be recounted by, you know, a lot of his childhood friends. Apparently there was one story, Gibb, where, you know, one morning he's on his way to school, walking, and he sees a dead crow in the road. I guess the crow had been hit by a car or however, but so what's Herb do? He picks it up, puts it in his pocket, as you would do.
Sure.
When you find a dead crow.
Save it for later.
Takes it to school with him. And then apparently while his teacher wasn't looking, he just puts it on his teacher's desk. You know, classic prank.
Right.
Dead crow on the teacher's desk.
Sure.
That's what we're kind of dealing with here with old Herb.
Right.
He enjoyed playing with dead animals.
Yes.
Is what I read.
Yep, he did.
And it's like a broken record. We keep saying that is a bad sign.
Right. Not you know, good.
Torturing Not good. Small animals, playing with dead animals. That's one we've heard many times. The one that I had never heard before, I don't believe, was that friends would say Herb had a habit of talking about that he wondered what human urine tasted like.
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
I think that's a new one.
It's a weird conversation to have.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what age or how long of a span of time this happened, but
right.
To just turn to your friend at, you know, in the lunchroom and say, hey, I wonder what human urine tastes like.
Yeah.
A little weird. So we've got some warning signs and bells that are going off at this point. And, you know, this urine fascination is going to come up. At one point, apparently he urinated on his teacher's desk.
Yep.
Or multiple teachers' desks. I'm not sure, but
normal kid activity.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, who doesn't
do
that? So, you know, he's given off these signs, and at some point his father starts to realize something's not right with his oldest son. And he kind of secretly takes him off for some examinations, a lengthy series of tests, and eventually, you know, he's diagnosed as schizophrenic, having two or more personalities, is what I read. The strange part about it, though, is that, you know, as far as I could tell, there was no record of any treatment. Well, so he got diagnosed.
But even if there was, his dad was probably pretty powerful enough in the medical community. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So maybe he was treated and it was, I don't know, the records were just lost.
Right. Who knows?
But maybe he wasn't treated and that's why
turns out
things get weird as we go along. You know, he was described as a loner in high school. He didn't play any sports. And he preferred to read books and keep to himself. Now, that's not crazy. There's a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
One of my daughters is an avid book reader, and she'd just assume sit in her room and read a book than,
sure,
you know, come down and watch TV on some nights.
Right. Nothing wrong with that.
But you start to put all these things together.
Well, I think it goes to the more of an antisocial.
Yeah.
Right.
I think one thing that was important to the story is his friend said that as far as they knew, he'd never dated throughout all of high school. And, you know, I think that's maybe a little foreshadowing of things that will come up. You know, he does graduate and he goes on to Indiana State University. home of the famed Larry Bird.
I didn't know that.
You did not know that?
I did not know. He went to Indiana State.
Indiana State. He actually went to Indiana to start and then...
Went up the road.
And then he went up the road to Indiana State. It's there at Indiana State that he meets his future wife, Julie Sater.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they hit it off immediately. I think they were described, Gibbs, as conservative Republicans.
Yeah.
So they had a lot of things in common. You know, they married in 71.
Yeah, but that's where it gets a little strange, I think.
Well, definitely, because what is it? Less than 6 months after they're married. I mean, Herb's committed to a psychiatric institute.
For a couple months.
Yeah.
It's weird to be married and 6 months into it to have to go off to the psych ward.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of information about why or, you know, what incident led up to this. But, you know, he definitely was committed. But, you know, he gets out and he gets a job. He's hired as a copy boy at the Indianapolis Star, which is a major newspaper there in Indianapolis. Probably in large part due to his father's connections, right? His dad is pretty well known as a anesthesiologist and, you know, helps him, I think.
Pretty strong community ties, I'm thinking.
There was some stuff I read that talked about Herb while he was there at the newspaper, which said he was very sensitive.
Okay.
As to the way that he was viewed and treated by the higher-ups.
So kind of paranoid or?
Yeah, I don't know. It said sensitive and it talked about that he obsessively wanted to be somebody. So he had some kind of drive.
Okay.
You know, or he wanted to be, I shouldn't say he had drive because I don't know if he did, but he wanted to be.
More than he was.
And he dressed well. He was eager. But then even at the newspaper, it was said that he did not fit in with the other, you know, with his coworkers.
Right.
So in 74, he gets a job at the BMV.
Well, that's a friendly place.
Yeah, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles.
Right.
Not to put down anybody that works at the BMV or the DMV or whatever it's called in your state. There might be a serial killer or two.
I'm just saying it's an interesting place to go.
I think it's one of those jobs that can really weigh on you.
Yeah.
You know. But again, I think this is probably another job that his father helped him get. And this is where he really starts showing his...
Yeah, there's a few strange things.
His, I don't want to say the word crazy, but his, whatever you want to call it, side. So 1 year, they had a company Christmas card, and I guess he and a coworker took a picture dressed in drag. You know, that's not crazy on its own. As with things that are going to come up, that's another sign that maybe Herb is not all that he appears to be.
Right.
And that's going to be a theme.
I think so.
You know, I think he tries to put on a certain facade, but underneath is something totally different.
Right.
And I guess that you would say the same about a lot of serial killers, I think you could probably say it about every one of them.
Yeah. This is the same job he had where I read that he had a cat. He found a dead cat, put it in a baggie, put it in the file cabinet at the bureau, and he would just over a period of a long time, he would just check to see how it deteriorated within the file cabinet, within the plastic bag, sealed plastic bag.
So it was already dead?
It was already dead.
It was already dead, and he was just watching it decay?
Yep.
I mean, what is wrong with these people?
It's just weird.
I guess maybe the plastic bag was strong enough to hold the smell in.
Because that's the first thing I thought about. Well, I'm sure if someone would have had to smell that.
Jeezy Pete.
But maybe it was a really good plastic bag. I don't know.
You know, at this point, like we said, he's married. And, you know, Julie quits her job. She was a high school journalism instructor. And towards the later half of the 1970s. and she wants to stay home to work on raising a family. Apparently Herb was making pretty good money, I guess, at the BMV, enough to where they only needed one income. Now, I think that was a lot more common back then.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
In today's environment, it's harder to do. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. It's pretty much a dual income family anymore.
It seems like it. So Herb and Julie would have three children. They would have a girl in 1979. They would have a boy in 81 and then another girl in 84. At this point, Herb's doing well at the BMV, works his way up to be the program director. I don't know what that is, but something happens, Gibbs, that stops that pretty...
Yeah.
Pretty abruptly. What was that?
Kind of looping back around to one of his favorite things, right? His fascination with urine.
Yeah.
Urine.
I can't even say it without laughing.
I can't. So I guess he decides to, you know, urinate on a letter that he sends off to, who is it, Mike? Was it
the governor.
The governor of Indiana.
I don't
Indiana.
Know if he sends it. I think it was addressed and supposed to be sent. Did he mail it?
I've got that he sent it to the then governor in Indiana.
Maybe
but,
he did.
But yeah, maybe, I don't know. But bottom line is that they figured out it was him.
Yeah.
You know, and so he loses his job.
Well, how hard is it to figure out? I mean, he's the pee boy.
He's a pee meister.
The pee meister.
This is weird. I'm sorry. I just...
It's not a funny story, obviously, but when you the thought of a grown man urinating on a letter.
Yeah.
And we don't even know why.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think, even if he worked for the, you know, he's working at the, you know, the BMV, I don't think the governor really cares about what a program director is doing. I don't think it has anything to do with his job.
No, but he cares if he gets a letter covered in
so
piss.
Why, I mean, how much, what did the governor do that made him so mad that he thought, I'll show you.
Right.
let me soak a little urine on your letter.
Well, and there's a reason why some of this is not known, which everybody will find out later on. But some of the facts can't be known.
Right.
Exactly. And one of them is what caused him, what made him mad, what caused him to do that.
What made him tick.
I mean, it's not a prank, right? Obviously, he was mad or...
Right.
About something. What's important is, you know, so that we said this is 85, and this is the same year that the body of Eric Roediger, who was a 17-year-old white male, was discovered in Indiana. And it is possible that this is Herb's first victim. Not conclusive, but very possible.
Very possible.
Now, in September of that year, Herb goes on to commit a hit and run while drunk in his car. He gets no punishment again.
Must have been the connection.
Connections, maybe 85. I think it was a little, we weren't as serious as we are today about drunk driving, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But he got no punishment for that. Less than a year later, in 86, he's charged with auto theft and some other kind of theft, conspiracy to commit theft.
It's just weird. You know, I mean, coming from a good family, dad's got money, why is he stealing?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, he lost his job and his wife's not working maybe. I don't know if that had something to do with it. But here again, he faces no jail time. He actually beats the charges. You know, my wife and I, we both use Rakuten when we shop online to help save money. My wife uses it more than I do because, well, let's face it, she shops more than I do. Rakuten is the most rewarding way to shop and save because members earn cash back on everything that they buy. Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while doing it? It really is a no-brainer. I use it for all my high techie stuff at stores like Best Buy. My wife uses it at stores like Sephora and Macy's. Best of all, membership is free and it's easy to sign up. It's very easy to use. Cashback rates change daily. So start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. True Crime All the Time is sponsored by BetterHelp. I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT. This turns the tide for Herb. It's just a year or two later where he has an idea to start his own thrift store, right? And he takes out a loan from his mom.
This is right after his dad died too.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I forgot that.
Yep.
I don't know how that motivated him, but you know it did in some form or fashion. But his mom loans him $4,000, and he opens up this thrift store called Save-A-Lot.
Right.
Now, Save-A-Lot, we know as a grocery store.
Yeah, not but, those.
But this is not that.
No.
Save-A-Lot.
These are like discount five and dime stores.
Right. I even read where he sold merchandise. I don't know if it was almost like on consignment, like people would bring in stuff. Could but have been. Anyway, it was a popular store.
Yeah.
Because I think he made, you know, like 50 grand in its first year.
Yeah.
So he opened it with four, he made 50, and that was enough to trigger him to open a second store. But the end result is that, you know, by 1991, so just really like 3 years into it, they've got these two stores and they're doing well enough to move into a very affluent neighborhood called Fox Hollow Farm.
Right.
That was the name of their, what's the word I'm thinking of?
Well, that was
the estate, name of almost their estate, you'd call it.
Their ranch.
Yeah, it was like 18 plus acres, I think.
Right.
Cost $1 million in 91. That's a heck of a house.
Yeah, back then.
So this was in the a district called Westfield, which is a suburb of Indianapolis, but like I said, very affluent. I mean, you can see the pictures online. Very, very nice. The marriage apparently was not very good. Everything I read, Gibbs, between Herb and Julie, you know, they spent a lot of time apart. They didn't get along very well when they were apart.
Well, clearly,
I mean, when they were together.
I mean, he went to the psych ward within months after being married, so... Something's up.
Yeah, something's up. You know, much later on, Julie would admit that she and Herb had sex only six times in the 25 years they were married. That's tipping me off to something.
Yeah, that's...
Well, they had three kids.
Right. So there was three of them.
So there was, you know, either three other times that it happened or... And the other crazy thing was... She never once ever saw him naked.
How's that work?
Well, he was the, you know, he would change in the bathroom, put on his PJs.
Oh.
Or I guess the six times that they did.
Lights off.
Was, yeah, lights off.
That's, huh.
So he had a, some type of phobia about his body.
Yeah.
I read a lot, some information about that. That was maybe part of his mental...
Could have been, sure.
Instability.
Yeah, insecurity.
But again, that's got to be some kind of red flag, right? Tipping off the wife that something's not right.
So, and so during this time, don't they allegedly find another body? You know, in 89, they found the body of Stephen Elliott. Around 1990, you know, Clay Boatman.
Yeah, I think they were finding bodies.
Right.
In Indianapolis. But with no kind of tie-in.
No, it was just yet some similarities to the way the bodies yes. were, right?
Right. And I think that's where we're going. You know, what I wanted to say was, at this point, on the outside, Herb's looking pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
He's a successful businessman. He lives in a $1 million estate.
Sure. Got an attractive wife.
In probably one of the nicest areas.
Subdivisions.
In Indy.
Right.
You know, as far as I know, I don't know much about Indy, but he owned, like I said, he owned a business. Everything I read said he was charitable. I think part of the business, the proceeds went to a certain charity.
Yeah.
He had that set up. So I think for the first time in his life, on the outside, he was successful and everybody thought he was doing really well.
Right. But on the inside,
things were completely different.
Right.
You know, so different that it's at this point that it's known that he begins to frequent local gay bars.
Now, his wife doesn't know this.
Oh, no. Well, to my knowledge, she
right.
doesn't.
Yeah, as far as we know, she doesn't. She doesn't have any knowledge that he's doing this, but he's hitting the nightlife at the many local gay bars in the area.
Which, again, I don't know how she doesn't know that. My wife seems to know where I'm at all times.
Well, I think we find out later why she doesn't know this.
Because they spent so much time apart?
Is yeah.
That, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was a big part of it. You know, one thing we didn't talk about was in talking about the house. So this was a really nice house and
yeah.
had a gorgeous pool out back with a wet bar. But there was some weirdness about it.
Yeah.
You know, Herb had all these mannequins, but they were all dressed like they were guests attending yeah. some pool party that he was throwing.
It was weird. I've seen that once before. I used to...
You can't tell me his wife didn't see that.
That's just weird.
Or did he... Maybe he kept them locked away when she was there, and then when she would go, he would bring them out like he's playing...
Yeah. What do you do? Hide them in the storage? I don't know. But it's weird. And there was a... I knew a guy up in Piqua.
You always know a guy.
I know. And this guy, he had mannequins throughout his whole house, and it was really weird.
Is this guy going to be listening to this and wonder why you're talking about him?
Let me just say it was really strange, and he would move the mannequins around. It was weird. It was weird.
Should we have this guy checked out?
I don't know. This has been a long time ago.
Oh, my gosh.
So anyway.
So back to Herb.
Yeah.
Right? It's known at this point. He's out visiting the local gay bars in Indianapolis, and... he's searching for victims. That's what they kind of trace back, but
right.
and
he's on the prowl.
He's on the prowl. He's posing as an autoerotic asphyxiation fetish.
Yeah.
Fetishist
expert.
Expert. Yeah, let's use that word.
Expert. What's what names do you go by?
Well, yeah, we find out that he's using the name Brian Smart.
Brian Smart.
Right? Where he got that, I don't know.
Oh, either.
But, you know, you got to talk about this autoerotic asphyxiation a little bit.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people will probably have some familiarity with it, not personally, but they'll know what it is. You know, it's basically when somebody receives pleasure from choking or the cutting off of the air supply.
Interesting.
There's been a lot of famous people that have died. One of the Carradines died recently, you know, within the last 3 or 4 years.
Oh, playing around with this?
Playing around with this, like in a closet.
Doesn't sound like it's worth the risk.
I know, but apparently it's a thing.
Yeah.
Like we said, Herb's out there. He's inviting men back to this pool.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to talk about the pool, because the pool is the setting.
Yeah.
For a lot of what ultimately takes place.
And we know the wife's not. The wife and kids aren't there.
Yeah.
They're up at...
her mom's cabin or
family cabin. you know,
some lake cabin,
a couple hours away.
Yeah, they went there a lot.
Right.
So this is the time that Herb would use to do his prowling and meeting these men, and he would bring them back to Fox Hollow Farm, and you know they'd be drinking and intoxicated, and the whole ruse, or eventually what would happen is they'd end up in the pool and he would strangle them.
Yeah.
Right. That was his,
well, he would sell them on the fact that, let me put this around your neck.
Right.
Right. It's going to give you the best orgasm you ever had. And he just would not let up on the strangling.
Yeah. So I think he, and I don't know if he on purpose was able to get other people that he knew were already into it. I mean, did he talk to him at the bar and it was known that they agreed that they were both into this.
Come on back to my place. Let me strangle you for a little bit.
Right. Yeah. But I'll let go. And the problem is Herb didn't let go.
Right. He didn't.
And he would strangle them till they were dead. So then after he would strangle them, he would discard the bodies in the woods behind his home. Now, again, we're talking about 18 acres. So
yeah,
pretty good size place.
And I think from what I read and understand is at first he didn't discard them at his house. He would drive them a pretty far distance. And I think they would, one account from that I got that he would take them out some country roads and throw them off a bridge into a creek. In this case, he went as far as Ohio and Preble County and disposed of two bodies that way. And then, you know, the expert says, you know, as he got more comfortable, like most serial killers do, they get more comfortable in their craft and they're not being caught. So then instead of going away from the home, he stays at the home and just takes them out to the backyard. He finds it a lot easier to do it that way.
Well, and that would make sense, I guess. I mean, not to me, but maybe to him that he's done it. And here again, we're going to say, we don't know, and I don't think anybody knows the total number that Herb Baumeister's ultimately responsible for.
No.
It could be way, way high.
Yeah, there's such a range that can be contribute to them, right? Because they start looking after the fact that most likely there's another 10 or 12 that could be accounted for on him, right? Because of the way that the guys died, the similar background.
But I guess, you know, if it was me and I'm not a serial killer, but if I've got my serial killer hat on, why am I burying the bodies in my own residence?
I sure wouldn't.
I mean, I know your theory and I believe it, which is at some point he got comfortable or he got lazy, one of the two.
Right. He was invincible.
Yeah. So overconfident that he thought, well, nobody's on to me. Nobody's ever going to catch me. But I just don't see, I don't get it. That's just dumb.
I would want the evidence as far as way.
Right. You don't want it in your backyard.
Yeah. I wouldn't want it anywhere any area I associate it with either.
Yeah. So it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, at this time, the police, they're investigating, but they're not putting a ton of effort in. And unfortunately,
not investigating him.
Well, yeah, but how much are they even investigating the murders early on? Because there was a lot of talk about the fact that because these were gay men that were missing, how much effort, and I'm using air quotes that nobody can see, how much effort was the police really putting into this?
Not too much.
Not too much in the beginning.
No.
And, you know, I think a lot of investigators and law enforcement, they thought that some of these people that were missing, they just had run off and decided to go to a bigger city.
And it's Indiana, pretty conservative state, so I don't think it was a big priority for them.
Yeah, and probably, you know, gay men in the 1980s, not a place that was probably very accepting.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it just wasn't a high priority.
And so I think that plays into them thinking maybe they ran off to, you know, New York or L.A. or something where maybe
San Fran, whatever.
Yeah, it was a little more accepted back then. Now today it's totally different.
Right.
But we're talking about the 1980s. Big difference. You know what I have, Gibbs, is it really wasn't until about 1994 when a private investigator named Virgil Vandegrift, and he would kind of become, you know, really involved in this case because the mother of a man named Alan Broussard, who had disappeared, comes to Virgil to hire him. It wasn't very long after that another mother comes.
Yeah, here's about how he's investigating the one
Broussard's
son
disappearance.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't long after that Roger Allen Goodlett disappears.
Right.
And his mom also comes to see Vandegrift.
Right.
You know, part of the reason is, you know, they had that waiting period. What, I don't know if it was 30
missing person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had to be so many days before you could declare somebody a missing person. And, you know, of course, these are mothers. They don't want to wait any time.
Right.
So instead of waiting for the police, they get with Virgil to help as a PI to try to help find their son. So, Gibby, we've got to talk about a character named Tony Harris. And I say character because that's not his real name. You know, this was obviously a real person, but we're not using his real name. And so Tony Harris had known Roger Goodlett, which we know had disappeared in July.
Right.
And he knew Roger from the gay bar scene in Indianapolis.
That's right.
He had seen Virgil Vandegrift's posters, and he thought he had some information that might help solve this whole case about Roger's disappearance. He had a crazy story.
Yeah, he sure did.
Right. His story was that he had been with a man who he was sure was a serial killer. He tried to tell the local police. They didn't believe him at all. They thought he was crazy.
They did.
And so somehow he got in touch with Roger's mother, and she put him in touch with Virgil Vandegrift, the PI that she'd hired. So, but we got to talk about this crazy story. It's not crazy, but it happened.
It's bizarre.
But it's bizarre. Basically, according to Tony, he had run into this guy at a local bar in town called the 501 Club. And he had actually seen him before around town. The guy was tall, lanky, didn't talk a lot. But they'd never talked before.
Right.
The two of them. But in August, on this particular night, Tony's attention was drawn to this man because he was like sitting there transfixed on this missing persons poster that hung behind the bar counter. And it was the poster for Roger Goodlett.
Yeah.
He couldn't figure it out why this guy was so
fixated
on this poster. You know, he got to talking with this guy. Guy introduced himself as Brian Smart, and Tony agrees to go home with the man. And so they drive home to Brian's home. Again, it's a very affluent community.
Now, Brian actually tells them that he is the caretaker for this property.
Oh, I didn't have that.
Yeah, he actually tells. That's his other, to separate him from
the actual owner.
Right.
Oh, that's actually makes some sense.
Yeah. So he tells them that he's the caretaker of the farm.
It's good information. Did not have that. So the two engage in some of that erotic asphyxiation.
Yeah.
Which is a hard word to say.
They drink, go swimming. Then they get the hose out.
I don't know if he sees the mannequins. And
he does see the mannequins. He finds that he thinks it's a little strange.
It's like a whole party, but
with
two people.
With two people.
Again, this one almost goes too far, right? Like you said, Brian's using a hose as part of this erotic play. I think at one point, doesn't Tony pass out or
something? He actually fakes passing out because Brian won't let up. So Tony figures the only thing he can do is fake that he passed out, hoping that he'll stop. And of course he does. And then when Tony acts like he comes back around, Brian is shocked. He's shocked that he thought he killed him, but he didn't. He's shocked that he's still alive. And a little side note on Tony. Tony is like a 6'5", 6'7", tall guy.
He's a big guy.
Yeah. So at that point, you know, I'm guessing that Brian decided that party was over.
Yeah, I think he played it off at that point.
Right.
Almost like, oh, you know, that was fun. You did great. Or, right, you know, something like that. But Tony asked Brian something very important. At this point, he basically asked Brian, is this what happened to Roger Goodlett? And Brian doesn't say anything.
Mm-mm.
The two get dressed and Brian / Herb,
right,
as we know Brian is Herb, drives Tony back to town. But so let's hear some, we actually have some audio.
One thing led to another. Within 15 minutes, I'm in his car going to what I've been told to be his employer's home in Hamilton County. The house was a very dusty place to be. Mannequins all over in different postures. I asked him about the mannequins. He told me that the owner didn't want to be alone. I was standing in the pool. He began to drop hints, you know, as to what he was into. He placed a hose around my neck. This was not an attack. This was asking, are you into this? He liked to be strangled, so he asked me to strangle him or to hold his throat, so I did. He fell unconscious down into the water. Within a minute, he came to, looks directly up at me, and tells me of the rush that he has, the exhilaration of the whole experience for him. He wanted to reciprocate with me. I allowed this. He had a way with his hands on your neck. Once he starts with this process, you don't want him to stop. You want it to continue. He could bring on a sort of ecstasy. He told me what turned him on about it was seeing the eyes bulge out of the head, seeing the lips swell up and at times crack, the discoloration in the skin. He spoke as if he was in some sort of ecstasy or rapture. I told him that he was hurting people. I told him that I would be going to the authorities. He laughed in my face and told me that no one would ever believe someone like me. I contacted the private investigator. I told him that a man was up in Hamilton County strangling people.
Pretty scary.
Yeah.
Right? Definitely to hear, you know, from somebody that essentially escaped death. I think if he had not done, as you had said, kind of faked unconsciousness, he would have ended up a victim, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
But he mentions there at the end that he goes to talk to the investigator, and that's Vandegrift.
Right, that is.
And so Vandegrift takes Tony and his information, and they go to the Indianapolis Police Department. And he goes to a very, shouldn't say very special, but he goes to a specific detective.
Right.
And it's a detective by the name of Mary Wilson. And Vandegrift knows her and knows that she is already working on some similar missing person cases.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he goes to her specifically. But we got to get back to her, right? Because these things are all kind of happening at the same time. And Herb's life is taking a turn for the worse.
Right.
It's going downhill. His business, which, you know, at one point had been doing really well, begins to fail.
Yeah.
And he starts acting very strange at the business, displaying, you know, weird attitudes towards the employees. By all accounts, started day drinking. He would leave work in the middle of the day, come back later and you know, be almost hammered, where employees could smell it. And I think at this point, he is arrested for drinking and driving in Rochester, Indiana. And that earned him 3 years in jail and a 1 year probation.
3 days.
Sorry, 3 days in jail and a 1 year probation.
Right.
To make things even worse, this is the, you know, kind of where things start to go downhill really badly, is Herb's son, Eric, finds something very important at the Fox Hollow Farm property. Gibby, yes. you want to fill him in on what that is?
We find some bone fragments, right?
Yeah, some bone fragments and a human skull.
As I say, that's the bigger piece, was the human skull.
Right. So he picks the human skull up, apparently, takes it to his mom.
Mommy, look what I found.
Yeah. I've got a skull here.
Right.
And, you know, she asks Herb about this skull. Hey, Eric found a skull in the yard. What the heck?
Right.
And Herb had a way of, you know, kind of putting her off, you know, as most serial killers do. I assume he was very manipulative.
Yeah.
And could manipulate people. And I'm sure he manipulated Julie pretty much the entire marriage. But, you know, his answer to this one is basically that, oh, this is a medical skeleton that belonged to his dad who had died. Again, you know, his dad was an anesthesiologist. I don't know why he would have a...
From old med school, I guess.
Yeah.
Try to sell that onto Julie. Yeah.
But she buys that. Now, later on, I think she starts to have second thoughts. And she goes out on the property and she's looking for these remains and they're gone.
Yeah. So clearly he cleaned them up.
Yeah.
But she's thinking, wow, an animal got them or something.
Right. Right. At this point, she's still not thinking anything is wrong, which I think, you know.
So and it's kind of around that same time. So you got to go back to Tony for a minute. And, you know, Brian is now thinking that it was a mistake letting Tony go. And so Brian's trying to locate Tony. And Brian gets a hold of him, phone number, and tries to see if they could hook up again. And, of course, Tony...
He's not real into that, I assume.
No, he's not into it. Kind of blows it off. But at that point, Brian's not going to take it. And Brian actually shows up, somehow gets information about Tony, shows up at knocks on Tony's door, which scares Tony, even at 6'5", 6'7", it scares Tony, to the point that Tony reaches back out to the detectives and the investigator. And from what I understand, they try to set up a sting outside of one of the gay clubs, but something, Brian must fill this out, know that something's up, and so Brian doesn't show that night, and then he's never heard of again.
Right, so they try to set a trap for him.
Right.
And he
doesn't either bite it.
Either sniffed it out or he thought it was a trap, and he doesn't show.
Nope.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling T-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are designed by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Don't waste time on apps that don't work. Babbel's conversation-based teaching prepares you for real-life situations. And studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/truecrime. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/truecrime, spelled BABBEL.com/truecrime. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I mean, you know, at this point, it's basically been a year. Virgil and the detective Mary Wilson, they're searching for this man named Brian Smart, like you said. His real identity and this house with all the mannequins and all that that Tony's talked about is still unknown.
Right.
You know, they don't know it's Herb and they don't know it's Fox Hollow Farms. So... But Tony Harris does have another run-in with Brian Smart a year later in 95. So this is after the sting attempt.
Right.
And he runs into him at a local bar in Indianapolis. And this time he gets something really important, and that is Brian's license plate number.
Yeah.
And gives that to police. Bam, they know, you know.
And for whatever reason, it was an Ohio license plate.
Yeah, I read that too, and I never did figure it out.
Yeah, I didn't.
Why that would be.
I didn't either, but it was an Ohio license plate. You know, Tony's in the club. Brian walks in. Brian doesn't see Tony, so Tony sees Brian start to leave. Tony asks one of his friends, hey, follow that guy. And he follows him and gets the driver's license plate number. And like you said, then they reach out to, Virgil, or did they reach out to Mary? Either way, I know that they got the
license. Yeah, it just said police. So I'm assuming that's either Mary or Hamilton County. Yeah, so now they know.
Right.
The plate belongs to Herb Baumeister. Now we know, come to find out, that he made many, many trips to Ohio.
Yeah.
Right, which we'll talk about later, and that's part of the whole I-70 strangler. But still, I did think that was weird that he was driving a car with an Ohio plate.
Right.
Maybe that was part of his plan to evade detection, but it's registered in his name, so...
Yeah.
I mean, that, I don't know what type of plan that is, other than the fact that it says Ohio and not Indiana.
Yeah, I don't really know the connection on that one.
You know, the police go to the Baumeister home and they ask to search the property.
Right.
They don't have a warrant.
Nope.
And both Herb and Julie refuse.
They do.
You know, Herb's telling Julie that, you know, hey, I don't know why they're here. I'm being falsely accused. Now, at this point, maybe she's got to be starting to put things together. It's a lot of things to put together, if you ask me. But she's sticking by him at this point and saying, no, you can't search our property, because she could have said that. It would have just taken one of them.
But she said no.
Yep. Now, they come back later, and the investigators are able to speak to Julie alone. And at that point, they're actually able to tell her what they think is going on. And Herb's not there. Even after this talk, and learning that her husband may be a serial killer, knowing that her son found a human skull in the backyard, she still would not let them search the property.
No, she even talked to her attorney, you know, while they were there on the phone, and she opted not to to cooperate. They needed someone to cooperate because at that point, Hamilton County Sheriff's Department was not willing to go to the court system or to a judge to get any type of
warrant.
Mm-hmm. They didn't feel the case was strong enough at that point. So either she was going to have to cooperate or nothing was going to happen.
Well, let's play this clip and then we'll talk about the clip.
Okay.
Once a body is found on someone else's jurisdiction, I go from being a lead investigator to being someone who's assisting.
We did not question Mr. Baumeister at the time. What we wanted to do was see exactly what we had first before we developed a plan of action.
To go the second day and bring the suspect in when you weren't even sure what you had up there, I can understand their side of it, but That at any rate, it was their decision.
I kept asking them, where is he? Where's Herb? And no one knew. They didn't know. And I didn't know.
So what you heard there was the gentleman was part of the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office, I think.
I think it was the sheriff.
And then Mary Wilson, who we talked about, was the first woman that spoke. And basically what she was saying was, in trying not to throw them under the bus, basically saying, you know, they didn't even question Herb.
Yeah. Let alone
bring him in or anything.
Right. There was a lot of disappointment from the different audio and things that I read on this case with the other police department involved and the investigator, private investigator. There was a sense of disappointment towards the Hamilton County Sheriff's Department that their sense of urgency was just not there.
And I think she's trying to be diplomatic about it.
Yeah, she is.
You can read between the lines of what she's saying.
Yeah.
And then at the end, that is, that's Julie.
Yeah.
So I wanted to put that in so people could hear Julie talking, you know, about Herb. You know, now we're into 1996. The Save-A-Lot thrift stores are shut down. Herb is depressed. I think at one point he threatened suicide. Julie is filing for divorce.
Right.
I think she's finally come to her senses. And she's suing Herb for sole custody of all three kids.
Yeah.
And it's at this point that she finally contacts the police and she agrees to allow them to do a full search of the property because Herb is away on vacation.
They're going through the divorce. She talks to her attorney. Tells the attorney about finding the bones and the skull earlier. So they have that conversation. And in between that, the attorney convinces her that it's probably best that you contact the police because, like you said, Herb is up at some cabin canoeing around with their
Son, yeah,
right,
Eric.
So I think she gets paranoid and has concern for her well-being of her son.
Yeah, I think because at this point she's divorcing. Herb's, like I said, talked
state
about
of mind.
Suicide. He's obviously depressed. Now he's alone with Eric, and she's probably freaking out, thinking
sure.
What could happen. So I think that's the catalyst for allowing them to, you know, search the property. So they do the initial search that lasts a couple days and they recovered, I think about 5,000-6,000 bone fragments.
Yeah.
You know, teeth from four different victims. And this is all in the 18 acre area of Fox Hollow Farm.
Right.
And apparently, I mean, these weren't even buried, right? What I read was that a lot of the remains were just concealed beneath leaves and garbage.
Yeah. Very, very lightly covered.
Yeah. Like just move a little out of the way.
Right.
I don't know what his state of mind was.
Maybe he realizes that things decompose faster that way from his experiments with the cat in the file cabinet and, you know, who knows?
I don't know. You and I sit and talk and try to get into the head of these people, and you can't do it because it's too crazy. You know, while they're digging, they got other law enforcement that is checking the inside of the home. They find the mannequins, they find the wet bar and the pool, and this really backs up the story of Tony Harris. Because remember, at first they didn't believe him. And then when he came with Virgil that second time, I think they did believe him, but now they've got the proof that really backed up his story. And they uncover something that I don't think anybody knew about except for Herb. And it's a video camera that was kind of hidden.
Right.
I think in the pool area, and it's believed that he had taped all the strangulations that happened in that pool.
Good old home videos.
Right. Now, unfortunately, there were no tapes found right then and there.
Right.
But the suspicion is that he had used that video camera to tape all the murders. And they believe a lot, most of them happened in that pool
area. Oh, I believe area. That. Yeah. Yeah, I definitely, especially, you know, when you find out how many bodies they find.
Yeah, so we talked about Julie's, she's getting real anxious about Eric.
Yeah, she is.
Because Eric's alone with Herb, and I think at this point, reality's kind of setting in for her.
Right.
And she's starting to worry about what Herb might do if he finds out what's going back on at home. Because remember, he doesn't know.
No.
At this point. He's up at Lake Winnipesaukee or whatever the hell it is.
Right.
That's not what it is, but like, what about Bob? He's up at Lake Wawasee. I'm going to go with Wawasee.
Is that like Willysville?
Like, kind of like Willysville.
Yeah.
So he's up at Lake Wawasee and they get a prosecutor and a county judge to draw up custody papers to take the boy away from her.
Right.
Because they're fearful. You know, he doesn't want to give him up, but at this point, he doesn't know that they're digging and finding all these bodies, like we said. So he just thinks that this is part of the custody battle. So when the police show up, they've got the paperwork signed by the judge and all of that. Herb does give Eric up to them easily with no fight or, you know, anything like that.
Which is, this part's strange for me. They're at his house. They're finding bodies, right? Bones. They kind of know what's going on, but they don't do anything with him.
No, again,
they don't retain him just for questioning anything. They just, thanks for the kid. Have a good day.
And they leave him up at whatever this lake, whatever cabin lake is.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what, you know, part of the frustration that you heard on the audio clip is,
sure,
at this point, you know, something's going on.
Absolutely.
There's too much smoke not to be a fire. But the fact that they don't bring him in to even have a sit down interview.
Right.
To me is crazy.
Yeah.
I don't get that at all.
And the sheriff in one video says they just didn't feel that they had strong enough reasons to bring him in at that time, but in hindsight, they probably should have.
Yeah, I think they had, what, almost 6,000 reasons?
Yeah.
Fragments?
Bone fragments.
Teeth. I mean, to me, that seems like plenty of reasons. There's a second search of the house that occurs, and this one is prompted by a neighbor, because the neighbor finds some skeletal remains near a drainage pipe that separates his property from Fox Hollow Farms. When the police get there, they immediately notice several pretty much intact skeletons.
Yeah.
That are basically just sticking up out of the ground.
Yeah, like rib cages and things like
that.
Yeah.
Not complete skeletons, but very intact is the way I had it. 140 additional bones. Like you said, some intact rib cages and vertebra.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, you know, they know this is 7 additional bodies after they start putting it all together.
Right.
And the other thing is they find a whole bunch of cans of Miller Genuine Draft, basically a bunch of MGD.
Yeah.
And that was known to be Herb Baumeister's favorite drink.
So he's drinking his beer while he's covering the bodies up, while he's
at his own house and drinking, throwing them, leaving them.
Yeah.
The guy is just,
it's bizarre. And I maybe, you know, Mike, I read a couple articles and it's kind of conflicting, but they actually didn't find many skulls. They found a couple skulls, but they didn't really find all the skulls.
So, right, because so in all, there's 11 bodies. Now, only 8 could be positively identified
through DNA studies.
Yeah.
Testing.
Well, I didn't say exactly, but I'm sure DNA was involved. To your point, if they had found more skulls, they probably would have had teeth,
the dental,
and had dental records.
Yeah.
And maybe that was a part of it.
It must have been, because I from what I understand, they couldn't find all the skulls.
Maybe he thought that it would be harder for them to identify if he was able to get rid of the skulls. I don't know. But again, I don't know why he just didn't. Now, I'm not trying to tell anybody how to get rid of bodies, but I just don't think putting them in your backyard under some leaves is the right way to go.
Yeah.
I mean, don't kill people anyway, but.
If you're going to do it.
But if you're going to do it.
Do it right.
Don't put them underneath, you know, just don't leave them out for somebody to trip over.
Yeah.
So I think we need to talk about, and we've talked about some, but now 8 of these 11 are identified. 2 we've already mentioned. It turned out to be, you know, Alan Broussard and Roger Goodlett. Those were the two individuals whose mothers hired the PI.
Yeah.
That kind of kickstarted, you know, maybe without him, I don't know if it gets solved.
At least they get close. I mean,
as quickly as it did.
Yeah. I think it's tough for the mom. Like it would be for any parent. You know, I did hear the one mom speak, and it was really tough on her when she found out everything at the farm, and she found out that one of the bodies was her son. It was devastating, but at least she had closure.
Yeah, so you've got another victim was a man named Johnny Bayer. He was 20. Richard Hamilton was 20. Stephen Hale was 26. Jeff Jones, 31. Michael Kiern, or Kern, was 46. And then the last one was Manuel Resendez,
mm-hmm.
who was 31. Now, we talked about Eric Roediger.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they've never confirmed, but there's very strong suspicion that he might have been the very first victim of her Baumeister. You touched on it, but he's also suspected of killing a lot more men who fit the very same profile. Because, I mean, that's one thing we haven't talked about. These are all gay men.
Right.
And so there was a lot more gay men that were killed and dumped along rural roadsides, like you mentioned.
Right.
And this spanned I-70 throughout Indiana and Ohio.
Yep.
And maybe even farther. I read some that thought maybe it went even a little bit farther. But, you know, it was well known. I think his wife said that he took probably more than 100 trips to Ohio on store business. And I think he would have had plenty of time to commit murders that took place on the property, like we talked about. He would have been undisturbed because she was hardly ever there.
Yeah,
or she was gone a lot with the kids.
Yeah, a lot of weekends and a lot of during the summertime, right? They would be gone for maybe a month or two.
Yeah.
Up at the cabin.
Several months at a time, it said.
So, I mean, he had fruit, right? And he would never go because he said he always had to work on the store. Right. He had to take care of the business, so he couldn't.
I always say I can't go because I got a podcast. So there's always an excuse.
But yeah.
Herb's still away. He's still up at this lake house. While all this stuff is hitting the fan, he's up at the lake house. He calls his older brother, and Herb claimed he was away on a business trip, and he needed some money.
Yeah.
A few days later, he calls his brother again and says he needs more money. By this time, he knows what's going on. He had caught wind that they were digging up bodies at his house. And so he's trying to get some money from his brother. And his brother, you know, called the police and said that he wanted to talk to him about these bodies that are being uncovered at Fox Hollow Run because his brother keeps calling him. You know, I just think at this point, Herb knows he's got no other options. What's he going to do? He can't come home.
Yeah.
He's going to be arrested the minute, you know, he steps foot back in the area. So what does he do?
He heads to Canada.
Yeah.
I think at one point, what's he get pulled over for? I know a local Canadian police pulls him over.
I had that he was sleeping in his car under a bridge.
Well, that's what it was.
So yeah. I don't know if he got pulled over, but
he was approached.
He was approached because he was sleeping under a bridge, which, you know, they're going to stop and ask you if you're doing that. So Herb tells the trooper that, you know, he's just a tourist on vacation, just passing through, and he got tired while he was driving. Now, the trooper noted in a report that, you know, he would file obviously later,
right,
that there was a whole big stack of what appeared to be like VHS tapes in the back seat of Herb's car.
There's the important tapes.
So I have a feeling that those were the murder tapes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And Herb took those with him when he went, which is kind of amazing. It means he had to have had them at the lake. So obviously he didn't feel comfortable leaving them in the house. Maybe he took them with him.
Or maybe they were always in his car.
Maybe you're right. Maybe he just kept them in his car or something like that. You know, this is where the story, you know, kind of ends for Herb. Mm-hmm. Because it's on July 3rd, 1996 that he goes to a place called, I guess it's Pinery Park in Ontario, Canada. He takes out a .357 Magnum and he shoots himself in the head, kills himself. He left a 3-page suicide note, gave a bunch of different reasons for the suicide, none of which were the fact that...
Never mentioned it.
He killed people.
No.
No, not once.
Failed marriage, failed business, but nothing to do, yep. Nothing to do with his actual crimes.
He blamed it on everything he could think of except for that.
Yeah.
And so going back to the very beginning of this episode, it's why technically he's an alleged serial killer, even though all these bodies are dug up in his backyard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he kills himself, so there's no trial. He's not convicted, but everybody knows he did it.
Right.
But technically, he was never convicted. So that's the strange kind of bizarre part of it. He did make a note of the fact that, you know, I guess he had originally planned to kill himself somewhere else other than this park. He apologized for messing up the park with his brains and blood and all that in his suicide note.
In the Piney Creek, wherever that park was.
Yeah,
Pinery
Park, I guess. So, sorry for messing up your park.
Yeah, that's really weird.
The guy's a nut job.
Yeah, he is. He is.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And that's, I almost hate to say that because there's, you know, mental illness is a huge issue in our society. And I'm not making light of that. This guy, he was so far beyond, I don't even know what to call him.
That's strange.
He was so far out there. So not only did he apologize, but he writes in the letter that his last meal would be a peanut butter sandwich, and that after he ate the sandwich, he was going to go sleep.
Okay. I don't know.
Three pages of this. So, like we said, he never confessed any of the murders. Mm-mm. There was more than enough, 10 times enough evidence to convict him.
Yeah, there was even a car, one of the cars he left on the farm, not the car he took with him up to Canada, but he left a car that only he drove on the property. And when the one of the investigators from Preble County, Ohio, came to the farm to look at the site, he saw the car sitting there, and he asked Julie, "Has anybody did anything with that car yet?" You know, and she said, "No, they never touched it." He was surprised that the Hamilton County never touched it yet, so he called for a tow truck and he took it back to Ohio to have forensics team in Dayton, Ohio, dust it, and they did find some minute blood samples in the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
But that when they opened the trunk, it was all stripped down, all the carpet, everything was pulled out. But on some of the where the spare tire was, they could find some blood. But when they did the DNA testing on it, it wasn't enough to be conclusive of who it belonged to.
Why does every one of these cases come back to where we live? It's so strange.
Well, it's Ohio.
Ohio is like the hub of...
Between Dayton and Cleveland.
Crazy stuff happening.
Yeah.
So there was one more, I think, very important part. We mentioned those videotapes. And the thought was that those were the videotapes that contained the murders. And the problem was they were not in the car when they found the car, his car.
What happened to him?
The theory was that maybe he threw him in the river before he committed suicide. His body wasn't even found for like 8 days, which I thought was kind of strange.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in a park. 8 days is a long time anywhere not to see a dead body.
I'm surprised no one's found the tapes all these years. You know, maybe they're at the bottom of the river and just that's where they're at.
Yeah.
Not that they would be VHS tapes. Well, they
probably couldn't salvage them, but
yeah,
be amazing if they could.
Yeah.
After all this time. You know, we've talked about the fact that there had been a lot of strangling murders along Interstate 70 in Indiana, and then a lot of them in Ohio as well.
Right.
Like you said, Preble County authorities, they really started to see the similarities between the murders that they were investigating here in Ohio and the murders that Herb had committed in Indiana. And from everything I read, everybody has agreed that most likely he killed, you know, all these people. It's why they call him the I-70 strangler. The other fact is the last known I-70 murder connected with all of that was committed in 1990, you know, which I think goes back to what you talked about, right? Which is he was branching out away from home. Now, he might have killed that one guy we talked about in Indianapolis.
Right.
That might have been his first victim. That could have been not connected to him at all. But I think he started out kind of far away from home, maybe on business trips to Ohio. And then for whatever reason, he started to get much more comfortable and started to operate
in his backyard. Yeah, that's bizarre, man.
I don't get it. But again, I don't get any of this stuff. I don't get why any of these people are doing what they are right. doing. You know, the other thing is in, you know, investigators, they were talking to Julie, obviously, and she was able to provide them with a lot of information, business records, credit card receipts, phone calls. They were able to line up some of Herb's activity with the I-70 murders.
Yeah.
Oh, not even to mention the fact that they had an eyewitness in one of the cases. And the composite sketch basically looked exactly
like him,
like Herb Baumeister,
Brian and Herb, all Brian the same. And Herb,
yeah, same people. There was even a press conference held at one point where police definitively said that they could link Baumeister with the I-70 slayings. Now there are people that don't believe it. You're always going to have those, but I mean that's good enough for me if the police come out and they've got enough evidence to say it. So you would think that would be the end of the story.
Yeah.
Normally, this is the part where we would say,
keep your own time
ticking. Stay safe and keep your own time ticking. But this story has a twist to it.
Yeah.
Because in 2009, somebody buys Fox Hollow Farm.
Buys the mansion.
Yep. And they move in. And apparently there was an apartment on the property.
Yeah.
And they were renting this out to a gentleman. This is where they start seeing, if you believe it, they start seeing all kinds of paranormal activity.
Right.
And I mean, to the point where this has been featured, Fox Hollow Farm has been featured on
a lot.
I saw at least 2, 3, 4, 5 different
yeah.
paranormal shows.
TV shows.
Where they've gone and, you know, they got the person that can see ghosts or whatever you call it.
Right.
Or has the meter like Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters, yeah.
They've spotted a man walking around in a red t-shirt. But all of this kind of activity that they're seeing, most of it happens around where they exhumed the bodies.
Yeah.
It's a little crazy.
Definitely bizarre. It's a bizarre ending to an already bizarre case.
They found all these bones. The cops still think there's tons more.
Right.
That they haven't found. I don't know if I could live there.
I couldn't, no.
Knowing all that stuff that happened?
No.
And we know the people's names. I'm just not saying them because I don't want to throw it out there. But
right.
I mean, I guess they're okay with it. I don't know if they still live there or not, but
yeah, I wouldn't.
I just don't think I could do it.
Yeah, wouldn't be worth
it. I mean, if what they're saying is true, I mean, some of the sightings that they've seen, you know, headless people, people floating in air with no legs, kind of like apparitions, a lot of knocking on the door, and then you get up and nobody's there.
Yeah,
I'm out.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah.
Now they probably got a heck of a deal on the house.
Oh, sure they did, but it wouldn't be worth it. I'm telling you.
No, not to me.
I wouldn't.
If you want to go down that rabbit hole, there is a ton of stuff.
Yeah, you can find all kind of videos.
On the paranormal activity. I mean, that's not what you and I usually focus on. But yeah.
I would need that little lady from Poltergeist to come into the house and do her thing.
I wanted to end on this. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt Herb Baumeister was a serial killer. You know, he checks all the boxes.
Right.
Now, Vandegrift, the private investigator, he actually compiled a report that was called Who is a Serial Killer? And I think it's a lot of the things that we all know. You know, serial killers are typically white males between the ages of 25 and 35, often married, has children, full-time employment. The majority of the time, they kill white victims.
Yep.
Which I think we know.
Right.
Intellect ranges from below average to above average. We've seen that kind of all along the spectrum.
Yeah.
He says that there's four main types of killers. The psychotic, the missionary motive type, the thrill killer, and the lust killer. And Baumeister is definitely that last one.
Yeah, the lust.
He's the lust killer, which is the most common type. Probably BTK was that.
I think so.
We covered him. The lust killer gets turned on by the killings themselves.
Yeah.
So I don't know if BTK was or not. I don't know what category he fits in, but Baumeister definitely fits in this.
He got off on the torture part, the killing part.
And one thing that Vandegrift says is that the more heinous the action, the more they become aroused.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it takes more, they go over the top.
Right.
Right. It takes more and more to get that same level of arousal. You know, we mentioned that Baumeister had poor body image issues.
Yeah.
He didn't like the way he saw himself.
Yeah. Like you said, his wife never saw him naked.
Yeah. He wouldn't let her. Herb also had feelings of what is called disassociation. So he was able to separate his feelings, basically able to kill one moment and then hang out with his wife and kids the next.
Yeah.
With no problem.
Yeah. Just flip a switch.
Yep. So he was able to put up a wall between those two.
I can do that.
I can too, but we don't kill people. Just do that another.
One of us doesn't.
And we won't tell you which one. Vandegrift talks a lot about the fantasy world.
Yeah.
And we've had some other people, right? They lived in a fantasy world.
Oh, they sure do. Yeah. It's not normal.
Talked about. You know, Herb had some trauma in his life. He had these issues. He had mental illness. And then on top of that, he had the loss of employment, the financial stress. He had all these other triggers that didn't help. And so it all kind of...
boiled up.
And then you have things that kind of accentuate that stuff, which is alcohol and drugs. And we know he was, I don't know how big of a drinker is, but he drank. He drank because he got some.
Yeah. And according to, and he did some drugs from what I understand from when I was listening to another account that Tony gave, that when he went back there, they had some alcohol and did some cocaine. But and back in that time frame, cocaine was the drug of choice in the higher social clubs.
Well, I think he needed to, I don't know if he needed to, but I think he wanted to get his victims in a certain state.
Sure.
Make them more pliable or more receptive to
the games they're about ready to play.
The things that he enjoyed doing. The last thing is the souvenirs. You hear that all the time about serial killers keeping souvenirs.
Sure.
In this case, they believe it was the videotapes.
Yeah.
And that he probably played those videotapes alone and relived the...
Oh, sure.
That over and over and over.
Played them back and masturbated them to them, probably. Probably. Yeah.
If you look at it in total, Herb Baumeister, and a lot of people may not, when they hear his name or they start to listen to this episode, they may have never heard of him. He is the consummate serial killer.
Yeah.
And he racked up a big total of kills. And it could be, like we talked about, so much higher than what is actually known.
Right. Yeah, you just don't know what the number could be.
But anyway, that's the story of Herb Baumeister, the I-70 strangler.
Yeah.
Gibby, you got anything else to add?
I don't. I feel bad for the victims, the victims' families. But
we always do.
I'm glad some of them got closure.
And again, we try to jump into the mind of these people, and it takes a while to... Because you and I, you know, we're researching this stuff all week.
Yeah.
And you kind of get into that.
Yeah, you do.
And how do you get out?
It's I'll tell you, it's tough.
I know.
It's
I think you're changing.
A little bit. Yeah. Yeah.
I worry about you. But. Yeah.
But I also wanted to say I felt bad for Julie and the kids, right? Because, you know, this is attached to them for the rest of their lives.
And especially the kids. I feel bad for Julie if she didn't know anything.
Right.
At some point, I just wonder
what she did or didn't
what
know.
She did or didn't know or should have known. I'm not sure she did know, but I think maybe in hindsight, looking back, she probably could have put pieces together a little quicker than she did. She definitely could have let the police search the property quicker, but I don't know that it would have saved any lives because I'm not sure.
I don't think it would have.
I think that people were the killings had occurred. As far as
if anything, maybe they could have gotten him and gotten the tapes, and the tapes would have helped identify
more victims.
But otherwise, I think, and I just feel bad for
the kids. You're right. Yeah, I feel bad, especially for the kids, but for her as well, because that's something that she has to live with. If she obviously didn't do any of this, so no matter what, I do feel a little bad for her. So, you know, for Mike Ferguson,
Gibby,
and Mr. Gibby. Stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.